This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Jim Cramer's Real Money by James J. Cramer. Read by the author.
I want you to be rich. Really rich. That's my goal. I don't want you to just do better. And I don't want you to try to make ends meet. I know I can help you get there. I've made too many other people rich for me to think that I won't do it with you. I got rich using common sense principles, not elite precepts and training. And I know you can, too. When I wrote Confessions of a Street Addict, I used to go into Amazon to read the reviews until my wife decided they were driving me nuts. What I found were people who loved the story of my life, but were disappointed that I didn't tell how I made my money. That's what this audio program is for. I tell everything. In fact, I'm debating whether to go back to managing money using the same rules and principles I outline here, because I'm so certain that they work. One note about this audiobook before we proceed. The final CD of this program is an enhanced CD. That means that besides the final section of this audiobook, the final CD also contains text and graphic files which accompany this program. I will be referring to these enhancement files from time to time throughout this program, so it would be a good idea to print them out now for your reference. For years, investors have tried to slog through how-to books about investing and trading, hoping to glean some wisdom that can make them wealthy. For years, writers have churned out these investment texts with an eye toward either dry academic theory or lightweight analysis that would not hold up under even the mildest professional scrutiny. There's nothing in between. Nothing to satisfy your craving for making large amounts of money through common sense and a modest investment of time, homework, and inclination. A total stock market junkie, I have either been bored to tears by these tomes or recognize that they are the works of charlatans who couldn't make you a dime. Most investing books, like most of the mutual fund managers out there, would probably do worse for you in the stock market than if you just picked a portfolio of the Standard & Poor's Benchmark 500 stocks. These texts are formulaic and arcane, or simplistic and overpromising. The authors don't have the benefit of a lifetime's worth of stock picking. They don't teach you what can go wrong as well as right. Those books are not this book. This audiobook is the distillation of everything I have learned, every important rule, every smart move, every edge I have ever been able to garner to make huge amounts of money in the stock market. I give you the secrets of how great wealth stays wealthy, secrets I have been taught by 38 of the wealthiest families in the world, the families for whom I managed money for 20 years. I made hundreds of millions of dollars for myself and my investors. I love the process of making money. I love talking about it, writing about it, and most of all, doing it. I know losing and winning. In many ways, though, I don't think of this audiobook as a financial book, or as a how-to-invest book, or a how-to-trade book. As a nationally syndicated talk show host and the creator of a company, TheStreet.com, where I have interacted with literally hundreds of thousands of investors, I know what you do wrong more than you do right. I know your financial weaknesses better than anyone managing money today. Maybe better than anyone on earth, including yourself. Most important, I know why you stray, why you can't consistently make money, and why you might consistently lose money by buying stocks. I know what will get you on course for a lifetime's worth of successful investing, not just a quick gain to your wallet. So in that sense, I think of this audio program more like a financial diet for life book, not a money book. Heck, I've written the first diet book of investing. I have pioneered ways to make the game of investing come alive so that you are interested enough and stay interested enough to last on my regimen to riches. I have spent a lifetime trying to explain the process of investing in English, using analogies to sports, to movies, to battles, to anything I can find that makes the stock market more simple and clear for you. I want you in charge of your finances. I want you to be your own guru. And I want you to like the process enough to take control. I know you. I know you want to speculate. I know you want to make some outsized gains. I know you will ride your losses if you aren't careful. And I know you will succumb to the junk food of finance, penny stocks, and the like, if you are left to your own devices. That's why, in my regimen, I build in speculation. I insist that you do some speculation as part of your investing menu. That way you can be truly diversified, own some solid blue chips, some good dividend yielders from many groups, and yet still have that lottery ticket that can't hurt you and can make you rich in a quick stroke. Remember, the biggest return generators of our life, the Home Depots, the Best Buys, the Comcasts, were incredibly risky, if not considered outright dangerous, just when you had to buy them aggressively. These were the stocks that turned thousands into millions, but would have been avoided by conventional investors because they were too dicey. I know for some this is heresy. I know there are well-respected pundits who will shudder at someone not taking the party line, someone not trashing speculation and all it stands for. For them, I say feel free to criticize my views, but don't deny that sometimes the easiest money is made in the dumbest, if not the most speculative, of wagers. Just as important, I show you what not to buy, what can ruin your portfolio, what kind of stocks are in what I call the danger zone, guaranteed to wreck whatever profits your other stocks might create for you. I teach you tricks that the other books don't know to keep those winners on and the losers off. Just because my audiobook makes the process of making money compelling, even enjoyable, doesn't mean that it's simple and can be done by everyone. I can get you started, but my methods take some time and some effort, and most important, some discipline. You will be rewarded if you follow them, perhaps with riches beyond what you dreamed of. But not if you don't do the homework, not if you don't pay attention, and not if you break any of the rules that must be followed, and there are many of them. Don't panic, though, at the notion of hard work to augment your capital. Nothing in this program is intellectually above the ken of my 13-year-old, and none of the processes of elimination and stock picking require more than the simple arithmetic precepts that no longer stump my 10-year-old. Some percentages, some division, some multiplication. That's as tough as it gets. I know how to teach and coach the financial diet. I know what it takes to keep you on it. I give you all the safe stuff that you have to have to keep yourself trim and wealthy. But I also give you the secrets, the stuff that I have learned that I believe will make you incredibly wealthy if you simply stay on the plan. I know it can work because I did it. My task is simple. Make the game compelling enough for you to stay on the diet that I know has catapulted me from a struggling writer making $15,000 a year to someone who never has to work again and does so only because I find the challenge of getting others to invest well to be the mission I believe I was put on earth to accomplish. So, get ready for some financial exercise. Get ready for a satisfying investing diet for all who crave big returns without big risk. If you look through my wallet, you will find all the things that everyone carries. License, credit cards, pictures of my wife and kids, and some cash. But if you look deeper in some of the crannies, you'll find two things no one else has. My first pay stub, a tattered, faded beauty from the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper from September 1977, and a snippet of a portfolio run from the lowest day of my life, October 8, 1998. I keep these talismans with me wherever I go, because they remind me why I got into stocks and why I had to stay in stocks no matter what. Because the opportunities are too great not to be in them. The $178.82 that I made that first week as a general assignment reporter in Tallahassee serves as a reminder to me that a paycheck is almost never enough to make a decent living on and to save up for the necessities of later life. That torn and bedraggled stub, with its $30 in overtime and oversized take by the federal government, keeps me honest and reminds me where I am from, how I never want to go back there, and how hard work at your job isn't enough to make you rich. You have to invest to make that happen. If you invest well, you should almost always be beating the return you get on your day job. The other smudged rectangle of paper in my wallet, the one that obscures the right-hand corner of my wife's picture, bears a series of cryptic numbers. 190,259,865. 281,175,544. And 90,915,674. The last number has a big black minus sign right after it. That's a cutout from my daily portfolio run on the most disastrous day my hedge fund ever had, October 8, 1998, a day when I was down 90,915,674. That's right, more than $90 million on the $281 million that I was supposed to be managing. I had lost almost half the money under my management in a series of bets in the stock market that hadn't yet paid off, to put a positive spin on an unmitigated decline. At that moment, everyone, my investors, my employees, the press, the public, everyone had written me off, except for my wife, whom I had worked with for so many years, and who knew never to count me out. "You've had it, Kramer. You're gone," the collective brokerage chorus told me. Not 2 months before, I had been on the cover of Money Magazine as the greatest trader of the era. Now, I was wondering whether I could survive the year. With just 2 months left, I had to find a way at least to make back that $90 million if I wanted to stay in a business that I had thought I was born for. Most hedge funds don't come back from those kinds of titanic losses. Using the very same tactics and techniques I will describe here, I methodically made back all of the money I had lost to date that year. And by December, I had returned to a slim profit for the year. I finished up 2%, a $110 million comeback in less than 3 months. I averaged $1.4 million in profits every single day. Yet I still waived my management fee of $2 million because I didn't think I deserved a penny, given how I had almost broken the bank. I still don't think I deserve to get paid for a comeback because I dug my own hole by not following my disciplines and my rules, by succumbing to a lack of diversification and to inflexibility, those two assassins of capital. That snapshot of how close I came to failure reminds me how important it is to stay investing and trading stocks, no matter what, because they are just too lucrative to stay away from for any long period of time. It also serves to remind me of how humbling this business is and how important it is to adjust course, for I have been sloppy and blind to a changing market during that catastrophic year. Had I not been flexible and willing to change strategies, I would never have come back. In the very next year after my near cataclysmic debacle, I made more than $100 million. The following year, I made $150 million. Again, using the same rules and techniques I will describe here. I had plenty of help in the $100 million year. The market was terrific, easy, almost straight up. But in 2000, the biggest year, the $150 million year, the market peaked and crashed. Yet I still profited supremely because you don't need the market to go up to make money. The fact that almost every mutual fund lost money in my biggest year is not a statement about my stock-picking prowess, but evidence that if you are disciplined, use common sense, and take advantage of all the devices and tools out there, you can profit no matter what. Or as I say at the end of my radio show every day, there's always a bull market somewhere that you can make profits from. But you have to stay in that game to find the bull market. In the end, when all else fails, stay in the game is the only mantra that's worth repeating. It keeps you from picking stocks that can wipe you out. It keeps you from speculating on situations that are worthless. It keeps you from borrowing a lot of money, known as margining, and hoping that stocks will make a magical move upward. It keeps you from wallowing in worthless penny stocks. It keeps you from trying to make a killing in tech. And it stops you from averaging down on bad stocks. Because stocks aren't like parents when you get lost at the mall. They don't always come back. Staying in the game is the ultimate lesson. How do I know this? Because it is what I have done. I have been able to make big money when big money could be made. Because I didn't get discouraged or fed up or desperate when times got tough. I didn't do anything illegal or silly or unethical to stay in the game. Because I knew that when the game eventually turned, I would be there to pounce on what was to be gained. But before I take too much credit for the system and methodology I used to keep me making money, I have to give credit where it is due to my wife, Karen, the woman the street called the trading goddess, for her manner and her proficiency in managing money and barking orders to dozens of brokers and traders. Karen was a professional institutional trader before I met her. She was responsible for taking me to the next level. She took a kid who had an eye for spotting undervalued and overvalued stocks. Then she grafted on a set of rules that have seen me through the darkest hours and allowed me to outperform, even when I don't have a great set of stocks on hand. In fact, on the day that my portfolio run dripped with $90 million in red ink, she had to return to the office to reinstill the rules and disciplines that I had forgotten in the 3 years since she had retired. She again drilled them into my head, so they now tumble out here almost by rote. Mrs. Kramer's rules, the rules of the trading goddess, make up a large portion of this program. Like me, Karen had no formal business school or accounting training. Like me, she lived from paycheck to paycheck until she found her true calling, making money in the stock market from scratch. Unlike me, she had no fundamental knowledge of how business worked, or how to read a balance sheet, or how interest rates control what you will ultimately pay for a stock. She always regarded these skills as overrated. What she understood was discipline and skepticism. The discipline to cut losses and run winners, and the skepticism to see through the hype that surrounds us on Wall Street. She understood better than anyone I have ever met that stocks are just pieces of paper representing shares of companies and no more than that. She knew that you could have conviction about where stocks could go and how high they could go, but it was only discipline that saved you when things didn't work out the way you thought. And she knew that things don't work out the way you think they will, far more often than you would like to believe. Sure, the pieces of paper we trade are linked, albeit loosely, to the underlying entities that issued them. But in Karen's eyes, it was always important to recognize that everyone, from the media to veteran Wall Streeters, places too much importance on this linkage, which is frequently severed by rumors, by larger market forces, and of course by short-term imbalances in supply and demand, all of which can be gamed effectively. Occasionally, stock prices are linked irrationally to the high side, as in Japan in 1988 and 89, or in this country in 2000. And just as occasionally, they are linked to the low side, as in September 1982, when the great bull market began, in October 1987, after the stock market crash, and in October 2002, the most recent important bottom that is restoring wealth through equity appreciation in this country. Karen taught me to spot these tops and bottoms, formidable skills that I know I can teach you. We all like to think of ourselves as conservative investors, but one of the trading goddess's most endearing and enduring traits is to recognize when buying, instead of staying in cash, is a conservative strategy, and when holding, instead of selling, is the riskiest strategy of all. We'll explore a little later the arsenal of both short and long-term tools and of using the downside of the market to make money, because that can be the most conservative style available. Most important, the trading goddess taught me to be unemotional and commonsensical about the direction of stock prices. While sports analogies help the business come alive, we can't root for stocks and stick with the home team. There is no home team. While dogma may pay in politics, it's a killer in stocks. While religion is important, hope and prayer are best left elsewhere when it comes to your money. They aren't valid here. While science has made tremendous strides in hundreds of areas of life, the stock market is not a science. It is just a humbling collection of pricing decisions involving the supply of equities and a level of demand mitigated by greed and fear, two animalistic psychological components. Those who try to quantify it, measure it, and use mathematical formulas to tame it will in the end be chewed up and eaten by it, as the biggest gang of Nobels under one roof, long-term capital management, a moronically reckless hedge fund, showed when it lost billions and went belly up in 1998. There are forces and emotions that determine how markets function that are not susceptible to academic logic. Often, to figure out how the market is valuing things, we have to go outside the balance sheet and the income statements, because the emotions of the market can blind you if you are constrained by those. But I'll teach you how to make sense of all the markets we have seen, how to understand the underlying patterns, and how to know when to avoid stocks or to short them, and to know when the sages and pundits simply can't be trusted, when they say, "Stay away, the market's too dangerous." Yes, stocks are pieces of paper, but they can be bought and sold with a level of emotionless precision that I can prep you for that will work in any kind of market. Broom the dogma, cultivate the discipline, open your eyes, and let's check out the basics in a way that contains, heck, the bus, all the genuine Wall Street gibberish that clouds so many minds trying to fathom why stocks go up or down every day. Many of you got started investing during an era when everything worked, when the economy was strong, interest rates were low, and stocks went up pretty much every day. Homework was an anathema to profits because it kept you out of the most promising short-term situations. That level of perfection had been previously unheard of, and is unheard of again. Now people feel that things are simply unfathomable. I think the opposite is true. Stocks can be fathomed, but you need the basics. And the basics weren't taught during the heyday of the late 1990s, when so many got into buying and selling stocks. And they certainly aren't taught at any level of school in this country. I know there's always frustration out there among the many first-timers, because many of you email me or call me at my radio show, Jim Cramer's Real Money, and ask me if I used to lose money regularly when I started. In fact, many of the millions of people who got their start in equities during the boom, bubble, and the burst of the late 1990s to 2000 are convinced that the business is a sucker's game and that you might as well just turn it over to someone who is a professional. But we are a profession without standards. The media, always so eager to tout any manager, regardless of credentials, especially if he is a good talker, never let you know that most of the professionals out there are rank amateurs themselves, often with much less experience at handling money and much more experience in sales than you. The astounding progression of individuals who first got clobbered by buying any old piece of trash online and then tendered their money to mutual fund charlatans who then sold them out to wealthy hedge funds is enough to make anyone throw his hands up in disgust about the process. First, let's clear up a couple of misperceptions about the business of investing. I always thought the buying and accumulating of stocks looked easy. But once I started, I learned about the hazards of commissions, about the changing nature of markets, and about the vagaries of the brokerage business. I learned that it seemed impossible to know enough to buy or sell anything right. No one could ever know enough to pull the trigger with any confidence. The task was too daunting. And of course, when I started, I lost money, big money. I would go on colossal losing streaks, where literally everything I bought went down. I experienced tremendous ups and downs that were psychologically debilitating. Often, I just wanted to return to the confines of whatever paycheck I was drawing and learn to be content with that income. But I always believed that stocks could be mastered if someone would just show me the landscape, if someone would explain to me the real pitfalls and give me the real rules, not the ones that I read in books or heard about on TV or saw in articles about the market. I call what I knew the mistaken basics. They are why, in part, I come to praise speculation, not damn it. Part of the reason that I failed so dramatically when I first bought stocks is that I, like everyone else who has ever bought a stock, believed in conventional wisdom about stocks. In fact, I can sum up the doctrine I foolishly believed in with three rules. 1. Buy and hold because that's how you make the most money. 2. Trading is always wrong. Owning is always right. 3. Speculation is the height of evil. The first thing we'll do is demolish these three shibboleths. They are blights on the investing landscape, idols that must be smashed before we go a step further. So let's do it. First, the concept of buy and hold is a beautiful thing because it presumes a level of ease and a level of perfection that we should all strive for. What could be better than a philosophy bedrocked in patience and conviction? Unfortunately, that level of conviction about pieces of paper, all that stocks really are, and don't you ever forget it, is impossible. Patience, while a virtue, can turn into a vice when you sit there and watch a good company go bad and hold on to its stock anyway, under the guise of prudence. Of course, given that no asset class has beaten equities over any 20-year cycle, it's natural to assume that if you buy stocks and hold them, you get to beat all other asset classes. However, the foremost academic on this particular issue, Jeremy Siegel, a Wharton professor, blanches visibly when he hears the distillation of his work interpreted as a recommendation to buy and hold stocks. Siegel's work shows that if you buy and hold good quality stocks that often pay dividends, you get the benefit of the cycle. In fact, the dividend portion is the reason why stocks outperform bonds, and not vice versa. Take it away, and you fail to win. Just buying and holding any old stock, Siegel will tell you, can be a ticket to the poorhouse. That's why, on Jim Cramer's Real Money, I've changed the superficial buy and hold mantra to the more arduous buy and homework doctrine, meaning that the real homework begins after you have bought a stock. Just buying and holding Sunbeam, Enron, WorldCom, Dome Petroleum, and Lucent, each at one time the most heavily traded stock of its era, was a recipe for certain disaster. Homework, which we'll go into in detail later, would have gotten you out of all these stocks before the damage and the rot set in. If you are going to make big money in the market, only with homework can you be sure that your stocks qualify as good quality stocks that can pay a dividend. Second, the idea that trading is somehow evil is ingrained in most individuals from the moment they begin to invest. Stubborn adherence to this point of view has led to more big losses than any other strategy I know. Trading, meaning the rapid or short-term buying and selling of stocks, is something that can prove to be entirely necessary if you are to be prudent and lock in gains when the market takes stocks past their logical extremes, which happens quite frequently in every generation of stocks. If you choose to never sell because you're afraid of the tax man or because you despise paying commissions, you need to get your head examined. Taxes these days are incredibly low, even on short-term gains, because ordinary tax rates are much lower than they used to be. And commissions? Forget it! Trades that would have cost hundreds of dollars in commissions when I first got in this game will now be done for about $7 by any discount broker. The liquidity of almost all stocks is pretty terrific since the advent of decimalization, where stocks trade in penny increments. You no longer get nicked for quarters and halves on the buy and sell. Pennies, just pennies, separate almost all the places you can buy and sell stocks. They just don't eat into the profit anymore. You can't use them as an excuse not to take a profit. In fact, you have to be a fool not to sell to lock in at least some of a big gain these days, lest it be taken away. The old bias against trading, however, remains, as people simply don't know how little friction there is between the buy and sell these days. Finally, the bias against speculation has taken on mythic proportions. I don't know of a soul besides me who thinks that speculating can be a handy tool on the road to riches. Yet I know that all my biggest gains came from pure speculation, which I define as making a calculated bet with a limited amount of capital that turns into a monster home run. I believe that speculation is not only healthy and terrific, but is vital to true diversification. You must be diversified to stay in the game when things go bad. But diversification without speculation is stultifying and can mean the difference between your losing interest, which is unforgivable, and your paying attention. Speculating, especially when you're younger, is not only prudent, it is essential to making so you don't have to be totally dependent on that darn paycheck to become rich. You gotta build in speculation as part of diversification It is a crucial component. I play a game called Am I Diversified every week on my TV program. I ask people to read me their five largest holdings. When they have done it, they have to ask me whether they are diversified. I feel so strongly about this notion that I've taken to asking why people don't have one stock bet that could make them significant amounts in a short time. I want to see speculation for a portion of even an older individual's portfolio, albeit only a name or two, a small percentage, to keep you interested. I know this pro-speculation view runs counter to anything you have ever heard or read, but this is how I made it big in the market. This is why I was able to beat the market, even when I was just starting out, both as an investor hobbyist and then as a professional at Goldman Sachs, before I went off to my hedge fund. Of course, a portfolio of nothing but speculation is like a diet of nothing but bacon and cheese. It'll kill you. But speculation in moderation is no different from enjoying some so-called fattening foods in an endless bid to stay on the healthier regimen. The current wisdom, though, is either buy and hold whatever strikes your fancy as solid, even if it isn't, or turn everything over to someone who doesn't care as much as you do about either capital preservation or capital appreciation. I know that academics and those market professionals who believe that stocks are priced perfectly don't believe that you can make large amounts with small investments in a short period of time. They think such situations don't exist, or that they are flukes, luck. Because they don't believe in them, and because you often search for them and fail, the tendency, the belief, becomes ingrained that there is no quick way to make big money. Let me give you an example of a situation I stumbled on in my younger stock-picking days. An example of what some would say was just rank speculation, but I say was a legitimate opportunity that might show you why I believe in speculating wisely. This opportunity came when I was younger and had almost no money to speak of. Precisely the time to speculate the heaviest, because you have your whole work life to make the money back if things don't pan out. At Harvard Law School, I managed in my spare time to work for Alan Dershowitz, helping to get the supremely guilty, at least in my view, Klaus von Bülow, acquitted on procedural grounds. The job paid well, more than $8 an hour. Despite being phenomenally bored with my law school classes, to this day I regard them as pure torture. I made it my business to go every day. I would check in on the markets every hour via the phone booths located outside the classrooms, usually reserved for homesick kids calling their mothers after particularly brutal grilling or exam. That spring, 1984, the oil patch had heated up. Getty Petroleum had just gotten a bid. I had made some money speculating in some call options, which for a little money provide the right to be able to capture the upside above a particular level of stock in the Conoco battle the previous year and in Sinclair Oil, another target not long after. I had small positions. Several hundred dollars worth of money I had saved from Dershowitz's chores in both oils and was drawn to the group. At this point, I was also managing a pool of money for my friend Marty Peretz, who had found me via my answering machine. I had such a hot hand picking stocks while attending classes that I began recommending a stock a week on my machine. Only later, in my third year at law school, did I discover that such a touting system was a violation of the 1940 Investment Advisor Act. But I hadn't taken that class yet, so who knew? After three straight weeks where he said I had made more money for him than any other person alive in the 30 years he'd been buying and selling stocks, Marty handed me a check for $500,000 over a cup of Joe at the Coffee Connection. I ran his money side by side with my little pool of cash. I told Marty that I thought our next big hit would be Gulf Oil. It just seemed too logical. I purchased us small amounts of Gulf call options. One day, while I was in class, Chevron launched a bid for Gulf Oil. I was gleeful after I called in and discovered I had had my first big hit. I had been discouraged when I had initially lost money from Marty, but this Gulf Oil deal put me in the black with him. I wanted to give his money back and just trade for myself. I hated the responsibility of running other people's money. Still do, but Marty wouldn't hear of it. Now we were back where we started, and I was feeling better about myself. That spring, I had been taking an antitrust class with the giant of antitrust, the late Phil Orita. Most of law school was a valueless blur, but this guy was a master. I still recall his classes, among the few I took seriously, because he was a great teacher. We were working on a unit on Standard Oil and the origins of antitrust law. I thought, you know something? This guy Arita knows what the heck he's talking about. Right after the announcement of the bid and the concomitant move-up of Gulf, the oil giant stock started slipping. One day during a break in class, I checked in with my broker, Joe McCarthy from Fidelity, and heard the disturbing news that Gulf had fallen back almost to where we had first bought the calls, on chatter that the government was definitely going to block the Gulf-SoCal merger. I was so distraught, I didn't even notice that the break was over, and I slunk back into class late, several minutes after intermission had ended. Arita was too much of a gentleman, and I was not enough of a scholar not to feel bad about coming in after class had started. At the conclusion of the class, I went up to him to apologize for my slothfulness. Arita knew I was one of these students who couldn't care less about law school. But he knew I was interested in business. I took a chance. I said, "Professor, I was late because I own Gulf Oil, and my broker says that the deal won't go through." He looked me in the eye, and he said something I would never forget. "It's a done deal." I looked at him the way a man looks at the piece of glass he just found in his backyard that he now realizes is a diamond. I said to him that I had real money riding on this one. Was justice going to block the deal? "Not a chance," he said. He knew the players. He knew Reagan's people wouldn't block it. I asked him again. He said he didn't have any more time to waste. If I had done my homework, which I obviously had not, I would have known that the decision was in the bag. I left the class and bet the farm for me and Marty on Gulf Oil, wagering just about every penny I had in the bank, some $2,000 at the time. The Justice Department approved the deal soon after, and I made a fortune for Marty and enough for myself to pay for law school and college and emerge from school free and clear. $2,000 turned into $25,000 just like that. And an indebted student who expected to labor for years to free himself of that indenture was freed before he graduated. I had speculated, and I had succeeded. Would I endorse this view if you called me on my radio show or met with me privately for a consultation? Yes, if you were young enough that you could afford to lose it all and still make it back. No, if you were older and speculating the same percentage of assets I did, which was just about everything. I want you to speculate, but as you get older, you don't have the rest of your life to make the money back from the paycheck side of the ledger. So naturally, you have to scale back and take smaller risks. But as a small percentage of assets, and with a hunch like I had with Gulf, absolutely. These kinds of informed bets are the best kind of investments, because the risk, the downside, is limited, and the reward, the upside, is monumental. I know, you won't always have the insight of some Harvard antitrust professor, but these kinds of home runs, while not as frequent as singles, do get hit every day in this business. Why is this kind of short-term thinking so antithetical to most investors? How do we get brainwashed into buy and hold forever? I think the literature on the topic is very much responsible for the misapprehensions about speculation, buying and holding, and trading. All investing literature has one thing in common. It refuses to admit that great investing, long-term or short-term, has much in common not with science or mathematics, but with gambling. There, I said it. We are wagering on the direction of stocks, both long and short. We are wagering in a way that we hope will allow a little bit of money to grow into something huge. We are betting that we can evaluate merchandise and figure out which can win. Which places, which shows, and which loses. If we get more winners than losers, we will grow rich. Once you admit that it is wagering, and that you have to monitor the jockey, the manager, as well as the horse, the company, as well as the track, the stock market, then you can make some sense of what you are up against and know which rules do and don't apply. That's why it is no coincidence that until now, I always recommended one text to those trying to figure out how to beat the market. One book, besides this one, that can change your view of investing forever. And it's not a book about stocks. It's Picking Winners by Andy Beyer, the premier horse racing columnist in the country, who until recently penned a column for the Washington Post. Yep, a handicapping book. Because the two, horse race betting and stock betting, are so alike that wagering rules he lays out apply to both. Beyer excels in handicapping horses. I excel in handicapping stocks. Beyer's main lessons, besides the basic need to be a good speculator, are vital for you to understand, and I will give you a variety of ways to master them. They seem simple, but in the reality of stocks, it will take plenty of practice and homework for you to use and maintain them. 1. If you learn from mistakes, you will not repeat them. 2. Only go to tracks where there aren't a lot of good players so you can clean up. The analogy here is only to invest in stocks where the research and information flow aren't perfect, and lots of minds aren't already trying to figure it out. 3. Only bet on situations where you have total conviction. Leave the rest to others. You don't have to play. You don't have to invest in everything that comes down the pike. Now, let's analyze how these three rules apply to stocks. First, amateurs must realize that much time must be spent doing homework. I will show you what homework entails, and learning the stocks you own. Approach it like a job, not a hobby. Second, while you can't be an expert on everything, you can learn a few stocks well and profit handily from those. I will show you where to find them, but you still have to do the homework when you get them. Most of all, recognize that you have to have an edge, something different that you can bring to the party. I will show you some methods you can use to gain an edge in your investments, using commonsensical approaches to the businesses around you. To get there, you must have a basic understanding of what stocks are, how stocks work, and why they go up and down. Only then can you make the wagers, both short and long term, that fit the rules that Beyer outlines. Only then can we benefit from his handicapping wisdom. We assume so much in this business, we who own and trade stocks. We assume that you understand what a stock is, what it represents, and how stocks figure into the capital structure. Those are blithe assumptions. I know this because I have seen people confuse shares of a stock with something that is almost tangible, something that is palpable. And that misconception leads to a level of certainty and lack of accurate skepticism that can betray you in a heartbeat. So let's take a second to explain where stocks come from and where they fit into the investment picture. Those who have been investing for years should still pay heed, because you may assume certain things too that may not be true. First of all companies need money, especially companies that are trying to grow. They can get money in a couple of ways. They can go to the bank, as we go to a bank to get a loan such as a mortgage. The collateral for the loan might be the inflow of cash the company expects, the receivables, or it might be the worth of the company itself. A company can issue debt or bonds that it pays interest on over time, and then when the debt is due, it pays back the principal. If the owners of the company are willing, or if some of the owners want to get money out of the company can issue common stock shares in the enterprise. A company's capital structure can be made up of shares that are issued to the public and bonds that are issued to the public. We all assume that the common stock the company issues represents the real ownership of the company. We proudly talk about how we own shares in the company and are therefore somehow owners of the company, as if we were all members of some grand club that owns the clubhouse. The first thing I want to do is disabuse you of that entitlement. When you own stock, you do have a fractional interest in the company if there is no other element in the capital structure, that is, if there's no debt. But owning stock itself entitles you to nothing. Worse, if the company has debt, the debt holders are senior to you and have more power than you. I call these folks the bond bullies. As long as the company is doing well, the bond bullies behave themselves and let the stockholders run the company. However, if the company loses a lot of money to the point where it can't pay the interest on the bonds, the bond bullies take over. I stress this because in the period from 2000 to 2003, many common stock shareholders were wiped out and bondholders took over the companies. The common stock shareholders in many cases did not know what hit them. They thought they owned the company. So remember, you only own it when things are good. When things go bad, you don't own anything but the piece of paper that the common stock is printed on. And you probably don't even have that, because almost all stocks these days are held electronically, with no certificates issued. The saving grace of stocks is that they can only go to zero. Don't laugh! I've owned some stocks that were so bad that it was a blessing that they stopped at zero. Each share of stock is theoretically worth something, a fractional share of ownership. But if you go to the company to redeem your shares to cash out of your ownership, the company will tell you that while it issued the shares, it won't take them back from you. Companies aren't department stores of shares. You have to sell those shares to someone else. In fact, the company can issue more shares at any given time to dilute your ownership in the enterprise. It can also buy back those shares if it wants in the open market, if it chooses to shrink the number of shares outstanding. Why do people own stock if the company won't take it back? Why is it worth anything? I know people who have traded stocks for years and years who have never asked themselves that. Yet it's a tremendous leap of faith to understand why an electronic entry of shares that can't be taken back to the company is worth anything at all. The answer is really twofold. There is an enterprise value to the whole company that can be bought or sold and can grow over time from the retained earnings of the company. And there is an income stream, known as dividends, that can come from the shares when the company is prosperous. If you own a stock that pays a dividend, you could be getting both the income stream and the value of an appreciating stock. Most companies, however, don't start out as dividend payers. Many other companies have no intention of paying a dividend because they want to reinvest earnings to grow the company and don't want to return any capital to the shareholders. Why do companies go public or sell shares to investors? What is the stock made of and what determines its price? Let's look at it through one situation I know well, one that is somewhat typical of the process, although each company, of course, is different from others in its own way. Let's look at TheStreet.com, a publicly traded company that I own a ton of shares in. Marty Peretz and I started the company in 1996 by putting in $100,000 every month. It didn't begin to generate any revenue until 1997, but then advertising on the web took off like a rocket, and we needed money both to pay people and to expand. The money we needed was beyond what Marty and I could afford. Frankly, while we were growing revenues or sales nicely, we were losing money hand over fist. We had no profits, which are sales minus expenses and the cost of goods sold. But we had two revenue streams, subscription and advertising, and we had a brand, which had some amorphous value. When we had burned through all the money that Marty and I were willing to invest, we had to raise money from other individuals, known as venture capitalists. They gave us money not because they were our buddies, far from it, but because they hoped to get more than their money back when the company was sold to another company or if it went public. That's a fairly typical situation for young, growing companies. After we burned through the venture capitalist money, we raised money from a couple of other companies, notably News Corp and the New York Times Company. They, too, gave us their capital in return for the right to have shares when we issued them. Then, because of the fascination with the stock market at that time, we hired a banker, Goldman Sachs, to tap the public's dollars. We knew people would buy shares in our enterprise for the reason they buy shares in many enterprises. They hoped we would one day either return a profit or be bought by another company for more than they paid for their shares. One of Goldman Sachs' main jobs was to raise money for us through an underwriting, or initial public offering, IPO. Everyone thinks he understands this underwriting process intuitively, but as one of the people who has worked on IPOs from the entrepreneurial side to the sell side, I can tell you they are rather mystifying. I was hopelessly naive. Here's the way it really works. Management of the company, which is typically clueless about Wall Street, has a meeting with the banker's corporate finance department, which draws up the documents for the offering and structures the deal, and the syndicate department, which prices the merchandise. The investment banking people tell you how many shares you are going to have outstanding and how many of those shares the company will float publicly. The syndicate person tells you what price those shares will most likely be issued at. Our syndicate people told us that they looked at companies comparable to ours and said that given how much in sales we had no profits, and how much money the New York Times and News Corp had paid, the company should be worth $250 million. The figure wasn't totally arbitrary. The New York Times and News Corp had valued it about the same, although it sure was hard to figure out why it was worth anything, given how much it was losing. Then, the investment bank said, arbitrarily that the company's ownership would be divided into 25 million shares. Of that, 19 million would be owned by the original investors, and 6 million would be sold to the public. I give you these numbers because there is no magic to the number of shares a company has. Goldman could have said that we were going to have 100 million shares, and 24 million would have been issued to the public. It could have said we will have 200 million shares, and 48 million were going to be issued. That's just how it works. The total share count matters tremendously only as a way to figure out how much earnings per share there are. Of course, thestreet.com wasn't close to having any earnings per share, but you can still figure it out by taking the overall loss we were having in a year and dividing that by the number of shares to be issued. So you can compare thestreet.com's earnings per share to those of other companies. I initially owned 50% of the company with my co-founder, Marty Peretz. When we invited the venture capitalists in, our 50% stake was diluted to about 30% each. With each new round of financing, we gave up more of our claim to the enterprise. By the time we contacted Goldman Sachs, my stake had been diluted to about 16% of the enterprise. Since each new buyer was entitled to shares, and the company issued shares to some of the people who worked there in addition to salaries. You may think that 16% is way too little versus where we started, but it is part of a much bigger pie than we started, so I was quite happy with the percentage. Goldman Sachs then conducted what is known as a roadshow, where it flies management to a bunch of cities to stir up demand. We already had a ton of demand for the shares before we started, so the roadshow was a complete waste of time, and should have been done over the web. But theoretically, you want to explain to people in person what the company does and what it plans to do. In actuality, the merchandise, the shares the company is issuing, was hot merchandise, meaning that everyone was clamoring for the darn stuff, and we could have just as easily sold it on eBay. But that's not how it works, unfortunately. It is during this period that people at the company write the prospectus, or selling document, which tells you what the company does, how it is doing financially, what the backgrounds of the people involved are, and then gives you a huge list of reasons or risks that tell you why you would be nuts to buy the company. It's a funny way to do business, but as I have said from the beginning, there's a lot of nutty, counterintuitive things about Wall Street that often are there just to confuse you and make you need someone who can help you, for a fee, of course. Most people throw the thing away immediately. But the prospectus can be an immense source of information about a company. You don't need to keep it. They are all online now, reachable with a keystroke. After the company's top officers have been on a plane visiting a dozen cities, the merchandise gets repriced by the bankers to take into account the stirred-up demand as the deal gets closer. For me, this was another totally eye-opening process. While we started the trip thinking we could get $10 a share, the price got lifted 7 times, the final bump to $19. It was only later that I found out that the plan was always to have it priced at $19, because that's the price Goldman thought would work best for everyone, the buyers and the company selling the shares. We insiders were restricted from selling for 18 months, and then we were only allowed to dribble out stock slowly so as not to crush the offering with too much supply. At this point, we were only allowed to buy more on the deal, not sell any stock. If we had been allowed to sell stock, that would be considered secondary stock, not primary stock, which is just for the company. Because the system for initial public offerings at the time couldn't really factor in all of the market orders, the company ended up selling 6,350,000 shares at $19. The stock opened, however, at $63, nowhere near the $19, as demand totally outstripped supply. Brokerages aren't allowed to issue more supply than they originally promised, and so many uninformed folks in the public foolishly used market orders to buy. They ended up buying the stock for 20, 30, and even 40 points more than they thought they would, because they used the dreaded market order system. Never use market orders when you can use limit orders, as I will explain later. Those who got the stock from Goldman Sachs at $19 on the actual offering mostly flipped the stock at those inflated prices and pocketed the $63 minus the $19 they paid. What a huge windfall for the customers, and what a monster shortchange for the company! But there are no do-overs in this business. Even though, in retrospect, we could have sold many more shares at a much higher price, the company still had to pay Goldman Sachs 6% of the proceeds for this one-day sale. Once the deal is done, the company has almost nothing to do with the shares again. The shares that come public, and then, in time, the shares of insiders, such as the venture capitalists and the corporations and the founders like Marty and me, are free to be traded. Although insiders can only peel them out slowly, since there are tightly regulated rules for how much stock you can sell at one time. Again, so as not to overwhelm the market. The price of the merchandise is reset every day through trading by the public, in this case on the NASDAQ, where companies can be listed that don't make money. You have to make money for a year before you can list on the New York Stock Exchange. Suffice it to say that once the deal goes public, the public sets the price from then on. For us at TheStreet.com, we had to watch the sickening slide from opening day at $63 to $1 a couple of years later, although it has since bounced back to more reasonable prices. You should remember those prices whenever you hear a silly academic say that the pricing system of stocks is perfect, meaning that it prices in all data precisely. Within a period of 2 years, the brilliant market